welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio, brought to you by OU Israel. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Vayichi. It is, in the secular calendar, the fourth day of January 07. In the Jewish calendar, last Sunday was Asara B'Tevet. That makes Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, today the 14th of Tevet. I could have told you that without counting from Asara B'Tevet, but I wanted to suggest a possible way that you would be able to know the Jewish dates. I'll talk maybe a little bit about that, because just yesterday I had another discussion with someone about the date in the Jewish calendar. Actually, I'll tell it to you now, and let's go back a couple of days. We sit down for a department head meeting at the Israel Center, and we are informed that we will be having these meetings on the first and third Tuesdays of each secular month. First and third Tuesday of each Chodesh Loazi, secular month. So I object. I said, if you're already making a meeting twice a month, why not make it based on the Hebrew calendar, the Jewish calendar? So there was a little discussion about it, and they says, all right, perfect, we'll have it on the first and third Tuesday of each Hebrew month, at which point I stood up and left, because this past Tuesday was the second Tuesday of the month. But that's not the point. The point is, and I've said it in many, many different ways, I'll say it this way, I and many people that I know always date our checks in the Jewish calendar. In this country, it is legal to refer to today on any kind of official documents, including checks, as the 14th of Tevet. Therefore, why should we not take advantage? Furthermore, I am convinced that every time a person uses the Hebrew date, what I mean the Jewish date, it is a fulfillment of the mitzvah, the very first mitzvah to the people of Israel, of HaChodesh Hazeh Lochem. This month is yours. Use your months, use your calendar. And I'm guilty of not doing that all the time and not doing it enough. Someone caught me on it yesterday, which is why I'm bringing it up now altogether. And he said, I looked through Torah Tidbits, and on the schedule of activities, 30 times you had the secular date, and only 4 or 5 times the Jewish date. And I guess guilty as charged. It's hard to tell people that there will be a particular lecture taking place on the 14th of Tevet, because people are not attuned to that being today. So I have to say January 4th. On the other hand, at least I should accompany the secular date with the Jewish date, because that's our calendar. Enough said on that. Without further ado, let us say Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. Shir HaMa'alot Mima'amakim Kraticha Adonai. Adonai Shima V'Koli Tehiyena Oznecha Kashuvot L'Kol Tachanunai. Im Avonot Tishmor Ya Adonai Miya Amod. Ki Imecha Haslicha L'Ma'an Tivarei. Ki Viti Adonai Kivita Nafshi V'Lidvaro Hocholti. Nafshi L'Adonai Mishomerim L'Boker Shomerim L'Boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut, v'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzara uvashivya, ha'omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, ha'makom yirachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha, u'me'afela la'ora u'mishibud l'geula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen. Earlier today, very recently, I gave a shir, Dvar Torah, whatever you want to call it, to the folders of Torah Tidbits, and the topic was on firstbornship, the status of the firstborn, especially as reflected in the book of Bereshit, which we conclude this Shabbat with a reading of Vayichi, which contains also a lesson for firstborns. It's, I guess, kind of self-explanatory if you listen to it. Let me put that shiur in now, and then, as they say, we'll talk more after.
I have a thought. Very so often I use this group as a sounding board, maybe more than any other group. And it's something that I wouldn't yet write about until I hear what it sounds like and get some feedback, maybe. I am a firstborn, and I've always known that. My brothers have always known that. I imagine when we were younger, I used to remind them of it quite often. My parents certainly reminded me of it. You're the firstborn. You should know better, you know, that kind of thing. But I would say, on balance, I'm glad for that. I have an aunt who's also a firstborn who has loads of pictures in her apartment of family. But she has one wall, which is firstborns only. So that if and I and Miri and Devere posed for a picture that we sent to her, and the mahadrin of that picture is that it's taken by a firstborn. So that was not mahadrin because it was taken by my son-in-law, who's not. And he feels it because my daughter-in-law, my daughter rather, is quite the firstborn. And anyway, there's books about firstborn, etc., etc. Now, the Torah requires that in the law of inheritance, a firstborn receives double portion, pi shnayim. It is, according to Ramban Nachmanides, a mitzvah aseh in the Torah to give the firstborn the double portion. It is a prohibition, according to Ramban, not to give it to him. Rambam lumps all the rules of inheritance into one positive commandment called the laws of inheritance. So far, all of this is besides the point. It's just a little background. I used to think that the firstborn is favored. Well, he is, you know, let's face facts. But I used to think that halachically, Jewishly, Torah-wise, that is the fact. And I'm getting to feel that it's maybe the opposite. What I mean by that is as follows. The world has gone through different cultures and different periods of history. The one that I'm thinking of, if I were a historian, I would say it's from this century to that century, and in this country and in that country. But there was a time, if not today, where the firstborn got everything, and other children, including sons, got nothing. That included, secular, in the secular world. That included the title. The Earl of Kuchiwachi is the firstborn. It included all of the property. At most, the other children would get a stipend of some sort from the master of the manor, or the lord of the manor, but the firstborn was the firstborn, which led to a lot of jealousy and a lot of killing off of firstborns, a la the 10th plague in Egypt, I guess. And, person who did it would defend himself by saying, well, God did it, you know, so not just kidding about that. But take a look at the book of Bereshit, which we're finishing this Shabbat. Start with Cain and Hevel. Cain, the firstborn of Adam and Chava, the very first child born in the history of the world, the first firstborn. And he makes an offering to God, which was not of the prime stuff. Hevel, his younger brother, offers a superior offering and is favored, and as a result, Cain kills Hevel. The result is not the key. The key is, in what I'm painting now a picture, the firstborn didn't make it. In other words, he was the firstborn biologically, but you will see a pattern emerging that a firstborn really has to earn that status in order to get it. Then jump all the way to Avraham. Avraham Avinu was not the firstborn, but he certainly was the prime child of Terach as far as we're concerned. He had Yishmael, his firstborn, true, not from Sarah, but from Hagar. And then you had Yitzchak, who was the heir, the spiritual heir and the physical heir of Avraham Avinu, to the point where Yishmael was banished from the house. The other children that Avraham subsequently had, the Torah tells us clearly, were given gifts, but Yitzchak was the heir. Yitzchak had Esav and Yaakov, and everyone knows the story there, where if you want to say, even though they were twins, Esav was the first to emerge from the womb. He was the firstborn. He lost it, or sold it, or it was taken from him, or however you want to describe it. But biological firstbornship did not win him the firstborn rights, the birthrights. That went to Yaakov. Yaakov had Reuven, interestingly, the Torah in Bereshit and throughout. The Torah calls Reuven the Bechor. But he wasn't the Bechor as far as everything else is concerned. Yehuda, son number 4, got the kingship. Levi, son number 3, got the Kohuna and Leviah. Yosef, son number 11, who was the firstborn of Rachel, got the double portion. Then, in this Sedra, Ephraim and Menashe, and picture Yosef, who suffered because he was treated by Yaakov as Yaakov's firstborn, and the brothers did not like that at all, and the rest, you know what happened. And here he is, going to his father Yaakov, who he knows the story in the family, I am sure, of what happened to Yaakov and the firstborn and the blessing, etc., etc. And he presents his sons very formally to Yaakov Avinu, with purposely Menashe on the left-hand side of Yosef, so that he would be on Yaakov's right, so that the easiest thing would be for elderly, infirm, blind Yaakov to just reach his hand out, and the right hand would rest on Menashe, and the left hand would rest on Ephraim, and Yaakov switches his hands. You could feel Yosef's panic. You could see Yosef's panic. He says, "No, father, that's not right." And his father says, "I know what I'm doing. Menashe will be a fine fellow, but Ephraim will be superior." So again, the status or the honor or the whatever you want to call it of firstborn, look in the book of Bereshit, it never went to the firstborn. So unlike the world or some of the cultures in the world where the firstborn got everything, the Torah on a halachic basis says, yes, firstborn gets a double portion. But I mentioned before, the mitzvah that a firstborn gets a double portion and the prohibition not to take it away from him. But there are another two mitzvot that Ramban counts, which are two mitzvot that are part of the laws of inheritance. And that is you're not allowed to disinherit any son. So where it seems on balance, every son gets one portion, the firstborn gets two portions, favor to the two for the firstborn, it's really maybe the firstborn gets only a double portion, all the other sons get a portion, and not like this business of firstborn gets everything, it doesn't matter who comes afterwards. So what I'm saying is combination of two things, and remember, I'm speaking as a firstborn. If I were not the firstborn, this would be a pitch for non-firstborns to rise up and rebel against their older brothers. Shabbat Shalom. But I'm not. I'm speaking from the perspective of a firstborn, and yet Bereshit is not a testimony to the glory of the firstborns. Then you come into Shemot, and Moshe Rabbeinu is not the firstborn. Besides Miriam, his older sister, Aaron was his elder by 3 years. And by the way, Aaron would not have been in the picture of leadership had it not been for Moshe's hesitation, repeatedly saying to God, why me? I'm not worthy of this, that, and somebody else. So God said, he didn't say it, but this is what the Mefarshim read in. God says to Moshe, you were supposed to be the total manhig, the leader. But because you keep saying that, I am sending Aaron to you. He will be glad to see you. You will be glad to see him. And he will be your spokesperson, and he will be your assistant. And he took that position of leadership. But Moshe Rabbeinu, second in birth to Aaron, is by far the superior leader. David HaMelech was the youngest child, the seventh child, to the point where he himself says in Tehillim, and we echo this when we recite Hallel, Evan Ma'asu HaBonim Hayata L'Rosh Pina. You're familiar with that verse from Hallel? I'll tell you what it means. Evan Ma'asu HaBonim, the builders, looked at this stone and they said, ugh, disgusting, get rid of it. Became Hayata L'Rosh Pina, the cornerstone. He was referring to himself, the put on, put down, bottom of the totem pole brother among his father's children, and he became Rosh Pina, the cornerstone of the dynasty of David. So, and then also back to Bereshit, you have Zerach and Peretz, where there, it's a little tricky. Peretz's hand came out first, then Zerach came out, and then Peretz came out, but Peretz was the one that had the Melucha, so the eventual Davidic line. So what I'm suggesting, and as I said before, this is a half-baked idea, I didn't use that language, but that's what it is, that firstborn has a certain halachic prominence, but it certainly does not trump real quality and deserving of leadership position. As far as the pure halacha is concerned, a father must give a double portion to his firstborn son. The Torah puts it in when a man has two wives, one he likes more than the other. That's not the way the words are. The words are ha'achat ahuva v'ha'achat sinua. One is loved and the other is hated. And the commentaries say, oh, come on, not hated, but certainly not top of the favored list. Lo yivaker. A person is not allowed to favor the firstborn of the ahuva over the real firstborn of the snua. Now, the Mefarshim have a field day there also. They talk about a man with two wives, both of whom gave birth on the same day, and you're not sure. One of them was born first, the other one conceived first. So, which one is the real Bechor? But that's besides the point. So the point is, the Torah says you cannot do it. Yaakov Lahavdil, oh, I don't know, Lahavdil. Yaakov Avinu did it. And here's the little chilling thing. I have no doubt, I would like not to have any doubt, that Yaakov loved Leah as well as Rachel. But when the Torah uses the terms sinua, it does not necessarily have to mean hated. It means not as loved as the ahuva. It's like a contrast kind of thing. And the Torah says it with Leah. It says, God saw that she was sinua, and he opened up her womb, and Rachel remained barren. So, and the word ahava is used there with Rachel. And then later in the Torah, with the laws of inheritance, you have it clearly stated. Ben ki tiena le'ish shtei nashim, a man has two wives, so you think of Rachel and Leah, even though this means any man with any two wives, and you think of a ben ahuva and a ben hasnua, and then you talk about giving a double portion to the ben ahuva. That's what Yaakov in essence did, because Ephraim and Menashe, Kiru Uvein v'Shimon, Yichyuli. Ephraim and Menashe should be considered like Reuven and Shimon. He was basically giving him a double portion. By the way, side point, it's not really so, because if you add Ephraim and Menashe together and call it Shevet Yosef, he's still smaller in the original census than Yehuda. Yehuda was the most populous Shevet. So the fact that you say to Yosef, you will qualify as two Shvatim, each one was smaller than the total, obviously, of the two together. The two together weren't even the largest tribe. So it would be, just in form of an analogy, if the state of Missouri were to split into North Missouri and South Missouri. So as far as House of Representatives is concerned, they would end up with the same number of representatives, maybe one less. As far as senators is concerned, they have two each. So they would gain by that. And in fact, the analogy is a cute one, because and a reasonable one, because Ephraim and Menashe are sometimes considered two separate Shvatim. Sometimes they're considered one Shevet. In Bamidbar, when God commands Moshe to gather an army to fight against Midian, and the Torah says that each tribe gave 1,000 men, so there were 12,000 soldiers altogether, there's a famous question as to whether Levi gave a contingent, and if so, did that make 13,000? But the Torah says 12,000, and Mefarshim say it wasn't yet Ephraim and Menashe, it was Yosef, combined Shevet, who gave 1,000, according to one school of thought, and Levi that contributed. Only when they got into Eretz Yisrael, where Levi was not to have a share in the apportionment of the land, then they were not counted among the tribes that fought for the land. And there you had the separation of Ephraim and Menashe, where Yosef became two. So it sort of is, and it isn't. But it all doesn't take away from the fact that Bereshit, in balance, is certainly not a book that the firstborn points to and you say, hey, take a look at the prominence of the firstborn.
Well, as I said, that was sort of a half-baked idea. Part of it just dawned on me, part of it I've been thinking about for a long time. Firstbornship is something that you have by birth, but whatever perks go with it really have to be earned. And I don't know if that's a valid conclusion from things in the book of Bereshit and elsewhere, but it certainly seems so. You are listening to Torah Tidbits Audio for Parshat Vayechi, one of the psukim that is very popular and well known, comes originally from Parshat Vayechi. Its popularity is due to the fact that it is also used in Kriyat Shema al Hamita, the Shema which is recited as one is going to sleep. And its real popularity comes from the fact that several different versions of it have been put to music, or it has been put to several different versions of music. And those songs became, I would guess you'd have to say, a Jewish lullaby. I know of many mothers and fathers who put their children to bed each night from a very early age, singing to them one version or another of Hamalach.
Hamalach Adoye Oisi Mikol Ro Hamalach Adoye Oisi Mikol Ro Yevorech Es Hanyorim. Hamalach Adoye Oisi Mikol Ro Es han yorim hamalach hagoyev oisi mikol ro yevorech es
Was Shlomi Dax with Hamalach HaGoel Oti. It's a pasuk in Yaakov's blessing to his son Yosef as he blesses Ephraim and Menashe. You have to look carefully in the psukim to see who's getting the essential bracha here. Is the blessing to Yosef, Yaakov's son, or is it to his grandsons through which it is really a blessing to Yosef as well? What father or mother is not pleased when their own children are receiving a blessing? Hamalach HaGoel Oti Mikol Ra, the angel who redeemed me from all evil, Yivarechet HaNe'arim, bless the lads, v'karevahem shmi, and let my name be named on them, v'shem avotai Avraham v'Yitzchak, and the name of my fathers, Avraham and Yitzchak, Abraham and Isaac. V'yidgu larov bekerev haaretz, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. Hamalach, the Jewish lullaby. And if I'm not the first person to coin that phrase, it won't be the first disappointment I had this week on that score. I came up with a term last week. It has always bothered me that you can say my son or my daughter is my child, and same for grandsons and granddaughters, they are your grandchildren. Your father or your mother are your parents. Your brother or sister, brothers and sisters, are siblings. But there's no one word in English, which there always should have been, for nieces and nephews. Sort of klutzy to say. Not even talking Hebrew, where everything is gender-specific, which means any of these words are going to have a masculine version and a feminine version. And then the convention of Hebrew grammar is that the plural, even in a mixed group, goes by the male form of the word. But in English, there are words. Some words, there's a specific word for the male, a specific word for the female, and then a combined word for the two together. In family relations, we have the following. We have cousins, but there is no word in English that I'm aware of for a female cousin as opposed to a male cousin. And maybe there should be. But there isn't. In Hebrew, there are B'nei Dodim and B'tei Dodim, I don't know, I guess that's female cousins. But anyway, we're talking English. Niece and nephew was the need. And I was pondering it last week, and all of a sudden I said, oh, I got a great word, nibbling. Siblings are brothers and sisters. Niblings, using the N of niece and nephew at the beginning of the sibling rhyming word nibbling, would become a word for niece and nephews. I mentioned it to two out of three of my daughters, maybe all of them. Everybody liked the term. Lots of people that I mentioned it to liked it, and people had been searching or felt the lack of such a word. And then I put it into a web search, nibbling. Lo and behold, it was not my original idea. I mean, I still claim it was, which brings up a whole other story, a whole other question. But I found reference back to 1989, not all that long ago, to nibblings. Several references, only in an internet dictionary, it appears. Most dictionaries do not yet have it. The word is being called a neologism, which is a new word just creeping into the language that has not yet gained official recognition. And that's a perfect example of it, nibblings. I invite anyone who's got nieces and nephews to use it. You can call a particularly young niece or a nephew a nibble if you want, although the singular of nibblings would be nibbling, of course. But a nibble could be a very small one. And we'll see. You'll have to come up with aunt and uncle. There is no single word for that. That would be nice. Cousins, there is no double words for male and female. So that's your assignment. And if anyone has these words, I invite them to share it with the rest of us. If you feel like writing to me at TTA, Torah Tidbits Audio, at IsraelNationalRadio.com, or TT@OU.org, we'll be glad to share them in future weeks. It's just one of those musings that I have. So I felt disappointed. Now let's turn that into a serious question. If you, anyone, has an original thought that turns out not to be original, how do we view it? This could be in the context of Torah learning or Gemara learning, where someone has an insight. It could be an insight in understanding a wording in a pasuk in the Torah, or a Rashi commentary, or a piece of Gemara, or whatever. And then you find out that a predecessor of yours several centuries ago or more said the same thing already. In fact, it's in print. In fact, you could open up to the back of the Gemara and you could find it there. How do you feel about it? I know that I definitely have mixed feelings whenever this happens to me. On the one hand, if I really, really enjoyed my ability to come up with a novel explanation, it feels good, feels very good. And then when you find out that someone else had the idea already and it's been written, it feels a little disappointing that it's not yours. On the other hand, it feels good because it sort of justifies your discovery. Yes, it really has merit. You know why? The Maharsha said it. The Ritva said it. The Ran said it. On the other hand, you begin to doubt yourself as to whether it really was original. Did I possibly read it or hear it? Or was other way, in any other way, directed towards it because it existed already as an idea? On a very tiny scale, I felt that way about nibbling. In more serious sense, I feel that way sometimes when I come up with an explanation, which I felt was a personal discovery. And I know what people say when I ask them about this. They say that, look, if you really didn't get it from anyone else and it came up on your own, it's yours. And that person's, and it doesn't take away from your creativity or your insight that it happened to have been said by someone else, if it genuinely is yours. In fact, I remember now that my 7th and 8th grade Rebbe, Rabbi Chaim Siegel, Zichrono Livracha, had each of us in class keep a small notebook to write down chidushim, creative insights and explanations to passages in the Gemara. And most of them were Rashi says this, Tosfot says that, the Ran, the Rif, whatever. Every so often, someone in class, one of the young fellows, would explain something which would be right out of one of the classical commentaries of the Gemara. The Rebbe would get very excited and engender that excitement in all of us. He would compliment the person who came up with it. He would say, the Rashba actually says almost exactly what you just said, kol hakavod, that you thought of it. And when we wrote it down in our notebooks, we had to write the Rashba and our classmate Chaim said blah blah blah. Very, very good thing. And the only time he didn't get so enthusiastic about it and was a little angry is when it was an explanation from Rashi, which he just taught to the class 2 minutes before, and you, the student, were daydreaming to the point and then thought that you came up with it on your own. Then he would give it to you. But otherwise, it's your thought and it's there. And again, in long summary, I invite you to use the word nibbling when referring to your nieces and nephews, especially if they're cute. And what nieces and nephews aren't. Let me change gears now. This is a story, a personal story from many, many years ago. I'm pretty sure I've told it in Torah Tidbits audio. I know that I have written about it in the past in the hard copy of Torah Tidbits. But it's a nice story from several different angles. It's like a Dvar Torah within a Dvar Torah. It happened, oh, let's say 1970-ish, that I was at a meeting at the national office of NCSY in Manhattan, and we were working on plans for an upcoming convention or Shabbaton. The senior person in the room was Rabbi Yehuda Leib Ginsberg, who now lives in Yerushalayim. In those days, he was director of projects and regions for NCSY. And several other advisors were there, and we're all working on the plans for Shabbat. It was Shabbat Parshat Vayechi, like this week, and somebody sneezed. And you heard a variety of Gesundheit, God bless you, Labriut, Asuta, or any other words to that effect. Rabbi Ginsburg said, I know we're all busy, but I have to tell you something. And he proceeded to tell us this Dvar Torah appropriate for Parshat Vayechi, and it went something like this. When Yosef is told, Vayehi acharei hadvarim ha'ela, Vayomer li Yosef hinei avicha chole, he is told that his father is sick. Commentaries say this was an unusual experience at the time, for Yaakov Avinu was the first person recorded as having gotten sick prior to his death. There was sickness, but it was never associated with death. Death came, say our sources, in an instant. A person lived out however many years he was destined to live out, and he expired with a final breath, a sneeze, let's call it, just as the Torah describes God breathing in the spirit of life into the nostrils, through the nostrils of Adam HaRishon, first man, Adam, so too life exited the body as a breath, as a sneeze, if you will. A person would sneeze and die. Yaakov Avinu got sick before he died and was acutely aware of his impending death, and that he took as a blessing because it gave him an opportunity to put his affairs in order. And one of the things that Yaakov says in the middle of blessing of his children is the famous three-word verse, Lishuatcha Kiviti Hashem. To your salvation I await, O God. The Shulchan Aruch says that when a person sneezes, he should say, Lishuatcha Kiviti Hashem. Not when you hear someone sneeze, you say that to him. You stick to Asuta, which is Aramaic for health, or Livriut, to good health in Hebrew, or God bless you, or Gesundheit, or whatever you want to say. But we're talking now about the sneezer, the one who actually sneezed. Our sources say that our reaction to our own sneeze is the reciting of the verse, Lishuatcha Kiviti Hashem. That was, let's say, the summary by Yaakov Avinu of his acknowledgement and resignation to the fact that he would to die, he was to die, and that this period of illness, as I said before, gave him an opportunity to put his affairs in order, to speak to his children, to bless his children, and to prepare himself for death. The combination of this, what I'm saying, with Yaakov Avinu, and the notion that a sneeze prior to Yaakov Avinu was the way that death was described, combines to say to us the following. A sneeze today doesn't mean you're dying. A sneeze means either you have a cold or something irritated your nose or you have an allergy. One way or the other, a sneeze and what it represents is a recognition that one is not, it's hard to put it into these words, 100% well. Of course, there are sneezes as a result of sniffing pepper that causes a person to sneeze, and it doesn't imply that the person is not well. But certainly the sneeze associated with a cold or an early symptom of a cold or a sign of a cold is in this ballpark. Basically, I'm trying to combine a couple of different ideas here, as Rabbi Ginsburg did way back then, that if we acknowledge God's role in our health on an insignificant thing like a sneeze, you sneeze and you say, Lishuatcha Kiviti Hashem. That's a pasuk in the Torah. That's a significant statement that puts God into your picture of your life. I really hope you get my point, because we're just about out of time for this week's issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. Enough time for me to wish you a Shabbat Shalom and Lehishtameah, which is the end of the show as it is broadcast on Israel National Radio. But if you're listening on OU Radio, you get a little bit more sometimes, a lot more, once in a while, nothing more. But these words are heard only on the OU Radio version. I'd like to play another song which relates to Ephraim, not necessarily the person, but in his role as representative of Yosef and all of Mamlechet Yisrael. The words from Yirmiyahu are also the Haftorah of one of the days of Rosh Hashanah. We quote the Pasuk in the Musaf of Rosh Hashanah, and it is a not yet good situation that's being described, because Ephraim has still disappointed HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, but it does carry that hopeful note that Ephraim is beloved to the point where he won't be punished that badly, and there will be a reconciliation, the one that we've been talking about with Vayeshev, Miketz, Vayigash, and Vayechi. This song is from an old Devekus album, and you will recognize it, I think, right away, some of you at least. But everyone, whether you heard it or not, please enjoy. Kind of a melancholy song, but not inappropriate, And I'll tell you why. We're finishing the book of Bereshit. The last number of Sedras were not good. Meaning, in Vayeshev, we learn of the hatred of the brothers for Yosef, the sale of Yosef, and what happens to him in Mitzrayim. In Miketz, he is elevated from prison to become a significant person in Egypt, but you can't really call things good because the brothers and Yosef are still at each other. Vayigash has the confrontation between Yehuda representing the brothers and Yosef, and it is followed soon thereafter by Yosef's revelation of Ani Yosef, I am Yosef, Ha'od Avichai, is my father still alive? And there's hugging, and there's kissing, and there's recriminations on one hand, and don't feel bad that you did it, God's plan, etc., etc. And you would like to be optimistic about this reconciliation. Yet in Vayichi, this week's Sedra, after Yaakov Avinu dies, having first gathered all of his sons together, which means the brothers and Yosef, so there you sense a reconciliation. As soon as Yaakov dies and the funeral is attended to, then the brothers come to Yosef, scared that he's going to now take retribution out on them. Because Yaakov is dead. He wouldn't do it in front of Yaakov. There are commentaries that say that Yaakov never found out about the sale of Yosef. And if it was Yosef's intention never to have Yaakov know that, then he certainly couldn't do anything until Yaakov died. But when Yaakov died, the brothers were honestly afraid that Yosef would take things out on them. And Yosef cried because they suspected him, and they cried in the situation. And the Sedra ends with everybody dying off, and we know that Shemot finds us in Egypt, and very soon after the opening words of Shemot, we are in bitter slavery and persecution. So the Haftorahs that have mentioned the clash between Ephraim on the one hand and Yehuda on the other carry with it the message that the clash between the brothers really continues throughout Jewish history, but you have the prophecy of the Messianic time when the brothers will finally be reconciled. But that's not yet. That's not at the beginning of the book of Shemot, or at the end of Bereshit, which is where we're standing, and it doesn't happen for a long time. So the song, which uses the words Havein Yakir Li Ephraim, which is a question, is this my favored son, Ephraim? Look at how he's behaving. But then there's the promise that love will remain notwithstanding the poor behavior, we'll say. In any event, we, if we have proper faith, take God's promise that things will work out in the end. It's still a sad state of affairs when we sense in our own society the friction among the brothers. Not for the same reasons, but the Jewish people are brothers and sisters, and the Jewish people are not, sadly, unfortunately, at peace with each other, let alone with the outside. And this internal tension is sometimes a lot scarier than any enemies from the outside. Sorry to end on that note, except for Chazak, Chazak, Venit Chazek, be strong and get stronger. And once again, I say Shabbat Shalom and Lehishtameah.